This case basically involves two issues. One, because it involves the issue of acquittal, I consider to be more important, and that's the sufficiency of the evidence to support the conviction of murder in this case. The other issue, somewhat less important because it would result in a reversal in a new trial, will be the exclusion of the recorded statement taken from Kimberly Millwitz. I have to confess at the beginning of this, there are actually two things here. One I am uncertain about. The other I am dead certain about. What I am uncertain about, if I make a statement with regard to something that may or may not be in the record, it's because I'm also handling Gordon Lewis's appeal. He was a co-defendant. I just finished that brief, and...
Well, we'll point it
out. Okay, I'm sure you will. The other thing that I am dead certain about is that in engaging in the analysis of the evidence in this case under the Jackson versus Virginia standard, is that if this court applies the same rigor, the same dedication, the same analysis as the court applied recently in Stovall versus State, I think that a just result in this case will be achieved. First of all, I concede that the state's citation of all the rules regarding evidence to support a conviction are correct. Where I differ with the prosecution under Jackson versus Virginia is that when I was a briefing attorney on the court, we still had factual insufficiency and legal insufficiency to support convictions, and we didn't have the unified standard in Brooks versus State until I was practicing civil law and wasn't practicing criminal law. So when I came back to this, I think the first thing that struck me is that Jackson versus Virginia is not a rationalization for affirmance at any cost. It's a quality control measure. Does the quality of the evidence support the guilt of the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt? Now, in this particular case, there is no direct evidence of my client's involvement in the actual nucleus crime. This was a sensational murder that occurred in Hood County, Texas, in which a bar owner was robbed and murdered. There is no question that Justin Reagan murdered him, shot him, and killed him. Without scotching my other appeal, there may be some question as to whether, to the extent to which Gordon Lewis was involved. But as far as Kimberly Millwitz is concerned, there is no evidence that she was at the scene of the crime. There is no evidence that she reaped the benefit of the crime. There is nothing more than a lot of rather questionable circumstances which might lead a reasonable person to suspect her involvement. But as this court said in Stovall, suspicion, even strong suspicion, does not amount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
It seems in your briefing, I haven't read the record yet, but that you all disagree quite a bit as far as who was the instigator of this plan or idea.
Very, very much so. And not only that, we disagree as to the definition of instigation. I don't know how many times, when I was in high school, we'd drive by a liquor store in East Texas out in the country, and somebody in the back of the car and say, man, I wonder why nobody's ever knocked that place off. That's essentially what we have here. Quite honestly, Your Honor, I like my client. She's a nice girl. As far as being the criminal mastermind, as the state depicted her in opening argument behind this robbery and murder, quite frankly, I think it's safe to say, having met my client, she couldn't mastermind a BB in a matchbox. To say that she instigated this or that she tried to goad somebody else into doing it is just not an accurate representation of the record.
The record does show that she told them two or three places where money could be found. She told them information apparently about their hours and when just one person would be there. Is that not correct?
That is correct. She also told them that there would probably be the most money there after the Martin Luther King holiday, which is basically exactly what happened.
Now, but in looking at that evidence, and I can see that's in the record. Now, I'm also going to tell you, you need to listen to that whole recorded statement. As you know, listen to that statement over and over again is like dental surgery without anesthetic. It's painful.
You mean the part that was admitted?
Yes, the part that was admitted. I'll talk about the part that was admitted a little later on, but it's basically 2 hours and 14 minutes of crying, sobbing, conflicting statements. But when you go back and look at that evidence, these statements were made during a car ride a week before it happened, where either Gordon Lewis was in the car, or Gordon Lewis and a guy, I think his name is Yates, Ray Yates were in the car. Mr. Yates wasn't even involved in the crime, yet he was supposedly discussing this robbery with Gordon Lewis. So we have these discussions taking place a week before. She tells him probably the best, and what she actually said was the best time to hit the place is Friday night. Friday night comes and goes and nobody hits it. And then lo and behold, Justin Reagan hits it on, I guess, the early morning hours of the 17th leading into the 18th. So I think that the court has to take that into consideration. Were the statements made?
Yes.
In the whole context of the case and the evidence that was presented? Is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And that's where I part ways with the state. What the state actually does in their brief
is what good civil lawyers try to do. We isolate the parts we like and we isolate the parts we don't like, and we say the jury could believe what we like.
You know, obviously they just believe what we didn't like. But if you listen to those statements, you know, did they ask you to be the getaway driver? I told them I'd be a good getaway driver, but I wouldn't do it. And when Gordon mentions robbing the place, she said, no, don't hurt him. Don't do it. You can't just take the good and then throw out the bad. If what you're talking about is a person's state of mind and their participation, what I would consider to be an extremely tertiary participation in a crime, results in a life sentence for murder. So,
don't hurt him, but she wanted to beat him to the bloody pulp with a Monty hammer.
Okay. Let's talk about that. Making a statement about one's dislike of another person isn't a crime.
I don't like you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the message was conveyed to me in reading the record.
Well, as I recall, she said, I want him to hurt as much as I hurt.
Yeah, sure.
That's right. The ball being hammered. I didn't actually hear her say, or I didn't actually see, I was working.
She never said that she wanted him. She never said that she wanted him to be killed. She said that she would like to see him beaten to a pulp. These statements were all made well prior to the robbery. And what I would submit to the court is, are they disturbing statements?
Yeah.
Would she have been better off not saying them?
Yeah, that's a pretty good bet.
But look at it, the court has to look at it in the context of there is no evidence whatsoever tying her to the scene of the murder. Now, if somebody had said, yeah, I saw her, she was over across the street at the convenience store getting a Slurpee, maybe then those statements might be relevant. Maybe those statements then would tend to tie her to the crime itself. But these were statements made a week before. Or I think one may have been made the night before when she said she dreamed about it.
Okay.
Again, disturbing
statement, yes.
Less than
peaceful,
probably. But evidence that she was masterminding a robbery by two other knuckleheads, no, not under the circumstances presented. And I think that the state, you know, whatever the insufficiencies of the evidence, I think that they did the best possible job they could working with what they had.
But everybody knows,
you know, no matter what you do, no matter how good a lawyer you are,
you don't get to make the facts up.
And I think under these circumstances, yeah, those statements are there. They're in the record. Rebecca Clear testified she wanted to see her beat down. I think Michael Eubank said the same thing. But again, without tying her to the scene of the crime, I don't think it's evidence. that supports guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
If she was incapable of planning this, as you told, were the knuckleheads capable of planning it? Mr. Fairley, there was just the three of them plus maybe Jay Riley. He was taken.
I mean, obviously, if they did plan, they didn't do a very good job because they got pretty much got caught right off the bat. At least Reagan did. Yeah, because I think, Your Honor, if you go back, if you look at the record, the conversations that took place at Rebecca Clear's trailer in this small room where everybody can overhear everybody's conversation, the implicit argument by the state, well, if you overhear a conversation about a robbery, you must be in on it. The state, in their brief, they quote a block of about 5 or 6 pages of testimony by Rebecca Clear saying Millwich was trying to get Reagan to go in on the robbery. Well, if you go back and look at the record, and again, I could be wrong about this, but if you go back and you look at the record of Millwich's case, Rebecca Clear said Gordon Lewis was having a conversation with Justin Reagan. Gordon Lewis was trying to get him to go in and rob TJ. Nothing in there about Kimberly doing, she was simply there. I mean, if the state's theory of guilt by association is correct, then Rebecca Clear should have been indicted, Christina Munoz should have been indicted, Gordon Lewis's, anybody else who was in that room listening to this conversation was equally guilty of the crime, and I don't think anybody accepts that proposition. So again, I have to emphasize that the state's case rested solely on the law of the party. And in writing my brief and going back and doing the research, I tried to find a case where the Court of Appeals or the Court of Criminal Appeals sustained a conviction where the mastermind, whatever, the planner-in-chief, you know, sent somebody off to commit the crime and then later was convicted of a murder that resulted. I couldn't find one in Texas. I didn't spend a lot of time researching law from other states or the feds. I understand I have 2 minutes, but I didn't find that case. So I would submit that all these cases involving party liability relied on by the state are like Gross versus State, where somebody was actually there. I do want to mention the issue of the main point I wish to make about her reported statement. The test is whether a reasonable person would believe they were being confined or that they were in custody. This was an interrogation that was carried out in Las Cruces, New Mexico by a Texas Ranger. Not the OG, but the Texas Ranger. In a police station. 4 hours at night
being recorded.
Two
rounds.
And what the state has done is taken a very clever ploy. Well, we got what we wanted in the first 2 hours. So we'll spot them the other 2 hours and just say that was a result of custodial arrest. But if you listen to the statement, the only difference between 2 hours and 13 minutes and 2 hours and 15 minutes is that at 2 hours and 14 minutes they said, well, we're drawing up a warrant for you. And as far as being in custody afterwards, they took her back to the hotel.
So there's no
qualitative difference
in the circumstances.
So even if you affirm on sufficiency of the evidence,
I submit,
under the circumstances,
you know, when you have an email from a Texas Ranger telling the other one in New Mexico what questions to ask,
I think that's a custodial interrogation under the circumstances carried out as it was
under the record.
So even if you find the evidence
sufficient,
I think you have to reverse based on the admissibility of the 2 hours and 14 minutes of the statement.
And
I know my time is almost up.
I ask that the court reverse the judgment of conviction and acquit my client of murder. In the alternative, I ask that you reverse the judgment and remand the case for a new trial.
But
I do ask that the court please carefully review the record like you did in Stovall. I mean, don't count on what I say. Don't count on what she says.
Judge for yourself.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Midler. Michelle here. May it please the court. In this case, appellant was charged with the offense of capital murder and convicted of the lesser offense of felony murder as a party to that offense. In this appeal, appellant raises two points of error. And in her first point of error, appellant argues that the evidence is insufficient to support her conviction for the lesser offense of felony murder. And in her second point of error, appellant argues that the trial court improperly admitted a portion of her recorded statement. Regarding appellant's first point of error, the law on sufficiency of the evidence is well established. In viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, an appellate court must uphold that jury's verdict. If any rational trier of fact could have found all of the essential elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. I have set forth the state's argument in my brief, and there I have included the evidence supporting appellant's conviction, along with detailed citations to the record. But I would like to take this opportunity to address some of the arguments raised by Mr. Minton in today's argument. He cited this court's recent opinion in Stovall v. State. In that case, Your Honor, is readily distinguishable from the case we have before the court today. In Stovall v. State, the victim's body was never discovered. And more than that, it was unclear what wrongful act, if any, caused the victim's death. And in this case, we know that the owner of TJ, Bar and Grill, Gene Fabian, was found shot to death inside that establishment. Mr. Minton also argues that there was insufficient evidence that the defendant was a criminal mastermind. And he argues that Ms. Milvis is a very nice person. And that may all be true, but that was a determination for the jury to make. And the jury heard all of this evidence and determined that it was Ms. Milvis who was a party to this offense and was involved in the planning of the robbery of TJ and the murder of Gene Craven.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit is it correct, as appellant argues in his brief, that the state has to prove that she not only planned her and carried the robbery, but that she, or doesn't, they don't have to prove it, maybe, but that she specifically planned and carried the murder.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, in this case, the jury was instructed on two theories of party liability. A conspiracy theory where if an attempt to carry out one conspiracy to commit a felony, another felony is committed, all conspirators are guilty of that felony actually committed, even if they have no intent to commit that felony, if that felony was an offense that was in furtherance of the conspiracy and should have been anticipated as a result of carrying out that conspiracy. And the jury was also instructed on what I have called an intent to promote or assist the commission of the offense. And so the jury could have found
She conspired to commit a theft or a robbery, and in the course of committing that, another felony was committed to commit a murder. Therefore, she's also responsible for the murder. So, but in the first theory, which is left on page 21 of the brief, it says she solicits, encourages, direct aid, or attempts to aid the other person to commit the offense. Well, I don't think that she can stretch it to commit the murder. Do you think it means the robbery
So I think the office would be the felony murder.
But you're saying that she solicited, encouraged, direct, aided, or attempted to aid in the murder? I'm hearing you on the robbery, but I'm stretching on the robbery. And then the second one sort of implies that she aided in the robbery, didn't know about the murder that just happened, but she's responsible.
Okay, and I'll also point out that in order to find the defendant guilty, they could find her guilty of the party under either theory, either the conspiracy or the intent to promote or assist.
So you only involve is your conspiracy theory?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I believe the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, Mazal versus State, which is 2013 Westlaw 663-6809, provides that under the intent to promote or assist theory of party liability for felony murder, the jury has to find that the defendant acted with an intent to assist the underlying body, which in this case is the robbery, and also the death of M-A-V-A.
So are you backing up and saying that attempts to aid the other person to commit the offense could mean a robbery and not the murder?
And gentlemen.
And gentlemen, that's what the name was saying.
I believe the Mazal decision says that under the intent to promote or assist theory of party liability for the offense of felony murder, the jury has to find that the defendant intended to promote or assist the underlying felony, which in this case is robbery, and also the death of an individual.
All right.
I believe that's what that decision is. Regarding appellant's second point of error, she argues that she was in custody when she spoke with law enforcement officers in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and because she was never given her warnings required under Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 38.22, and Miranda v. Arizona, the entirety of her recorded statement should have been excluded at trial. A ruling on a motion to suppress a defendant's statement is reviewed for abuse of discretion. An appellate court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling, but the trial court's application of the law to the facts is reviewed de novo. And to provide some brief background on appellate's second point of error, on the day of James Stevens' murder, appellate left Hood County and headed towards California. Law enforcement officers caught up with her in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where they found her in a motel room. When Texas Ranger Kevin Rice knocked on appellant's motel room door, appellant opened the door and said immediately, "Is this about Jean?" And the Texas Ranger responded, "Yes, it is. We would like to talk to you about that. Would you come with me to the New Mexico State Police office?" Appellant was not placed under arrest, was not told that she was under arrest, and was not handcuffed. Instead, appellant voluntarily agreed to accompany the Texas Ranger to the New Mexico State Police Office. And once she arrived at that police office, she spoke with two Texas Rangers for approximately 4 hours. At no point was appellant given her Miranda warning. And at the conclusion of her interview, she was taken back to her motel room and arrested a short time later. Prior to her jury trial, the trial court ruled that any portion of appellant's recorded statement made after 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 33 seconds would be suppressed. And the reason for this was because at that particular timestamp, the Texas Ranger told appellant that the district attorney was drafting a warrant for her arrest for the offense of murder. critical to appellant's second point of error is whether or not she was in custody during those initial 2 hours and 14 minutes of her recorded statement. The law on custody is also well established, and a person is in custody when there has been a formal arrest or a restraint on her freedom of movement to the degree associated with an arrest. This standard presupposes an innocent person. An interrogation that begins as non-custodial may escalate later into a custodial interrogation. And that's exactly what we have in this case. It was appellant's burden to prove that her statement was the product of a custodial interrogation. In Dalbert v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals set forth 4 general situations that may constitute custody. And these 4 general situations are not exhaustive, but they do provide some guidance on what may constitute custody. The first of those 4
Do I perceive that the question is not, when did she think she could leave,
but when in fact could she leave? Correct?
Well, if I'm understanding your point, the subjective beliefs of the appellant have no bearing on the analysis of custody.
Therefore, what difference did it make when she was told they were drafting a warrant for her arrest?
Okay, does that affect the
Yes, Your Honor.
So she is a reasonable person to objectively believe that she was. She claims to her she had been accused of the murder.
Yes, Your Honor.
But was it only at that point, or could it have occurred prior to that point? The time for objective realization.
It was only at that point, because prior to that point in the interview, the Texas Rangers never conveyed to appellant that they had probable cause to arrest her. And in fact, they weren't even sure if they had probable cause to arrest her, because it was unclear before the interview began, and thank you, Your Honor, and prior to that 2-hour, 14-minute timestamp, whether or not appellant was going to be a witness in the case or a suspect in the case.
I'm still struggling. If they locked the door so she could leave, does that mean that she's in custody? Or
if she believes the door is locked, she can't leave, but she's in custody?
Okay, well, it would depend on the circumstances surrounding the interrogation of the questioning. Here, the door was never locked. The appellant was free to leave. She was offered food and water, offered to use the restroom. She had her cell phone with her during the entire interview. She called people that she knew, and at one point she even called her father and talked to him and said, "I'm not being detained at this time." It depends on the circumstances surrounding the questioning. The warnings required by Miranda v. Arizona focus on the coercive nature of the environment. And here, those 6 circumstances simply are not present. Because the appellant was not in custody during the admitted portion of her recorded statements, officers were not required to comply with Article 3822 in Miranda v. Arizona. For this reason, the trial court properly admitted the first 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 33 seconds of her recorded statement. For all of the reasons I've discussed today and that are set forth in the state's brief, I respectfully ask that you overrule appellant's 2 points of error and affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
I have a follow-up question. Do you have or find any cases where a statement is split into 2 parts? In other words, are there lots of cases that show that a portion of the statement can be non-custodial and then it can change into a custodial statement? Are there cases that say that?
Yes, Your Honor. And the top of my head, I'm not able to think of one. But I believe it was in Delphic versus State that the Court of Criminal Appeals held that an interrogation that begins as non-custodial may escalate later into a custodial interrogation. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan.
All right, Mr. Minton, rebuttal.
Brief rebuttal. Let me address the issue of the statement first, and I want to come back to a question that Justice McCoy raised, or a topic that he touched on. Look, when she called her father on the cell phone and said, I'm not in custody, my recollection, and I firmly stand to be correct, my recollection, she made that telephone call during the second part of the interrogation, during the second half, after halftime. So, I don't think that's, if the state is saying, well, that was custodial interrogation, I don't understand why that phone call really makes any difference. That's the first point I want to make. The second point I want to make is there's no difference. Qualitatively, there's no difference. Other than scaring her to death by saying they're drawing up a warrant, there's really not much difference in the other 2 hours of the statement. And where did the information for that warrant come from? It came from the first 2 hours of her interrogation after she says, is this about Gene? Yes, it is. Would you please hop into my truck, drive 2 miles with me to a police station to sit in a room with my buddy and talk into a microphone? Wow. I mean, the only question he didn't ask, well, that's the point that I'm making, is that, look, any reasonable person of these circumstances would believe that this was a custodial interrogation. And the state, I agree. I think the state's tactic of spotting them the last 2 hours, okay, it's a good tactic. But when you look at it, I mean, what's the reason behind it? Because we got everything we needed in the first 2 hours. Look, this was a result of bad police work by these two rangers. All they had to do was read her Miranda rights, she would have said the same things in her statement as she would have before. I think that's exactly the case. Chief Justice Livingston, I don't recall seeing a case that addresses exactly that.
About the two-part statement.
But what I'm saying is, look, there's no difference in the circumstances.
She wasn't in.
The only reason that the court threw it out, the court didn't rule that the second half was inadmissible. The state said, yeah, that's probably inadmissible. We're not going to run it. Okay. Well, then I deny the motion, and I'll allow the first 2 hours to be played.
Okay.
Good trick, but still a trick. Let me move on to, if I could, in the brief time I have left. Justice McCoy, you asked, and she answered that the conspiracy theory was the lead dog with regard to sufficiency of the evidence. Where's the meaning of mine? If I ask a question of Mr. DeWitt, do I agree with him? No. There's no meaning. If conspiracy, I always thought conspiracy was the weaker of the two. But if that's their lead dog, show me the meaning of mine. Show me how you can discuss a robbery on a Friday night with Gordon Lewis and Ray Ray or whatever, and then with no other evidence, no other intervening events, the robbery actually goes down with another guy actually pulling the trigger besides Ray Ray and Gordon Lewis more or less being around the scene of the crime. And somehow or another, by agreeing to Friday, you also agreed to Monday night. I don't get that. This is no meeting of minds. This is an aid or encourage case, and I don't think it's a good one at that. Justice Gardner, as far as the Nava case is concerned, I did look at that last night, about 11:45. I remember a little bit about it. That's before I went to sleep and dreamed about a ball peen hammer. But if there's something in the case, I'll submit it by letter brief. But I think if anything, as I recall from Nava, it actually supports our position rather than undercuts it. But again, I have to emphasize, both as part of our case in chief and on rebuttal, look at the record. Do the job you did with Stovall. You don't have to write a 176-page opinion, but, I mean, look, a lot of careful thought went into that. And
you know, my client is entitled to the same due process right to be convicted only on proof beyond a reasonable doubt, even though you have a body, as a case where you don't have a body. I'm not saying that Stovall is on all fours of the situation. What I'm saying is that the principles of analysis are exactly the same. My client's entitled to the same due process in Hood County as somebody's entitled to in Denton County. And with that, unless there are any other questions, again, I ask that you acquit my client. In the alternative, please reverse for a new trial and throw out the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minton. Ms.
Shalfoon, we appreciate the arguments and all of the briefs. Thank you for being here. That concludes our submissions for today. So we will adjourn the court. So we will stay here and we'll give you 5 or 10 minutes if you all have any questions, not specifically related to these cases. And of course, the lawyers are invited to stay with us because you might get some questions other than from us. Please adjourn the court.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
All right, thank you, Mason.